13 minutes after 9 o'clock. You've got it on KHUM. And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. This week, we've been talking about survivor strengths, tools, and strategies. We've talked to some amazing folks thus far, and we'll round out our one-on-one interviews today with Professor Michael Yellowbird from Humboldt State University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in.
Absolutely. So I guess we're going to be looking a lot at how the mind works with regard to violence and healing and whatnot. And I guess the key word, and we talked a little bit off air, is mindfulness.
Right.
So explain to folks what mindfulness is.
Well, mindfulness is actually this process where folks develop a sense of a really deep awareness about what is happening in the present moment. There's a guy by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn who's developed a cited definition, cited very often by people in the literature and also practitioners. It's, you know, being present in the moment and understanding what's unfolding before you and not judging that experience or not attaching to it, and just being fully aware of what's going on at that present moment, whether you're having an engagement in a discussion with someone, whether you're eating your food, or whether you're sitting down in meditation. And the important thing about that, how it gets back to neuroscience and neurobiology, is that when you begin to quiet down the circuits of the brain, especially the deep limbic area, which is responsible for emotion, one of the things that happens is that you have a lot less neurons firing in your brain, and you begin to get a sense of calm after a while. But it's very difficult because, although talking about mindfulness and saying being present at the very moment is an easy thing to say, it's very difficult to achieve for many of us, especially in today's world when we're over-stimulated by all kinds of technology, all kinds of cell phones, iPads, laptop computers, and constant texting and Twittering and all those kinds of things. So we get all these different kinds of outside things competing for our brain resources. And then we've got all our own inner talk, you know, that's going on, like, am I good enough? You know, I'm traumatized, you know, I wonder if I'm, you know, meeting the, you know, the goals of my life. So you've got all these different kinds of competing internal and external things fighting for your attention. So it's very difficult. But the payoffs with mindfulness, we're seeing in the research, are just tremendous.
So mindfulness, how does this correspond with, say, getting past a traumatic act of violence that you have lived through?
Well, what mindfulness does is begin to, as I said, it when we start to do the practice, we're really practicing turning off some of those brain regions that have been overactivated by the violence. For instance, and other things that happen in the brain. So I don't want to forget this, but there's a thing called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, and it's this cluster of proteins in the brain, and it's good stuff because it helps prevent neuron death in the brain. But let's take the case of bullying, for instance.
Sure.
And that's been a big talk with folks all around the country. What's happened in some studies, at least one study that I know of, is that there's mice have been put into these same cages, and the mice are the models. And this big white mouse, in this particular study, began to bully this little brown mouse. Bullied the mouse all over, bit him, and threw him around the cage, and chased him around until he was very stressed out. Now, what the researchers did then is sort of put a plexiglass between the two mice. They took a look at the mouse, and they took a look at his brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Now, we need that. It's got to be stable in our brain. They found out in his little brain that it was really elevated, which makes sense because it puts him in a place of social withdrawal and anxiety and, you know, to pull away from the experience that's going on. It makes perfect sense. And so that's what happens in bullying. So what the little mouse then, what the researchers did then later was take the big white mouse out of that was very aggressive, put him in another cage, and they just left his scent in there. The little mouse still continued to, brown mouse continued to cower in another corner, didn't come out, still exhibiting signs of social withdrawal and anxiety. And then the researchers put little white friendly mice in there, and he still exhibited these these same kinds of tendencies. Well, in the end, what they looked at is they found out that his brain-derived neurotrophic factor had been elevated, and elevated for a survival mechanism, but it led to social withdrawal, isolation, and this great anxiety. So when you look at kids in this way, it makes perfect sense in terms of bullying, that when they're bullied, their neurotrophic, brain-derived neurotrophic factor rises, and it stays, at a high level, which then, of course, you know, can be not good for a neuron survival, and which can lead to other things like cutting, which can lead to kids cutting themselves, maybe committing suicide or threatening suicide. But all these things kind of come together. So these are sort of the consequences of what happens when people are put into this kind of violent situation. Now, what we know is that mindfulness, when people begin to detach from those experiences once they're safe, and begin to look at those experiences as something that's happened to them rather than it's real happening all the time, then that brain-derived neurotrophic factor and other kinds of factors in the brain begin to sort of subside and go back to closer to normal levels. And so, I mean, it's what I'm talking about is survival, and mindfulness, we know, can help people in traumatic situations.
So this is a conscious decision to be mindful, to help get past that kind of thing.
Well, it's conscious in the sense that and some people will take it on just in terms, I won't call it instinctual, but they'll know that, you know, it's better for them to take a break from whatever traumatizing them, calm their minds, take deep breaths. That's all just part of mindfulness, to sort of see where their brain is, to sort of see how their body feels, to see what they're experiencing. But in a sense, if it's conscious, people who teach mindfulness and understand the neurobiology of it, because I think there are differences. There are people that just teach mindfulness that really don't understand the neurobiology of it, which is fine. Then they can put those two things together and understand how a person can actually use what they call self-directed neuroplastic approaches. And that person says, okay, I know that I've been traumatized, and I know for me what's important, that every time that traumatic experience comes up for me, I should sit down and I should check in with myself. And I should do that even before I feel anything traumatic going on. And so what some folks do is they have people who have been traumatized throughout the day periodically check in with themselves. And one of the nice things about cell phones, one of the few nice things about cell phones, is you can put applications on them. And there's certain applications you can put on where there'll be a gong that rings for mindfulness meditation, and you can set it for an hour a day and every hour during the day, and it goes off, and the person can take a deep breath, take 2 or 3 minutes just to see how they are, and calm themselves, and just begin to think about, like, where's my mind at, where's my brain at? So mindfulness is not just sitting down doing meditation at one point. It's a consistent practice that goes on throughout the full day, and that's the conscious part of it.
It's interesting. It's what you're talking about is, I guess, not generally part of the Western culture, but has been part of many other cultures for thousands of years.
Yeah. It really has been on all kinds of groups. I mean, mindfulness is not just something you sit down to meditation. When you look at the stars and you gaze at the stars in awe and at their beauty, and you don't have any other distractions, but you're just looking at them and being with the stars, that's a sense of mindfulness. When you sit and you mindfully eat a bowl of soup that your grandmother made, and you taste all of the different ingredients and the sensations and the texture and the temperature of the food, that's mindfulness. So it's really widespread. Now, it's not so much a Western thing, and that's kind of the interesting thing about it, about what I say is kind of the politics for me of mindfulness, because prior to people coming to this part of the world, indigenous people had all of these different kinds of mindfulness practices that they did. And it's clear when you look at a number of pictures, when you look at ceremonies, and some people still do those kinds of things today. Mindfulness dances that are sacred and secular. Mindfulness speaking of language, of learning sacred ceremonial songs, of doing things like fasting, all kinds of different things that people engaged in. And of course, there were the sitting, vision-seeking meditation kinds of things as well. When Europeans, European Americans came here, they were very much in the sense of being religious and looking at what the native people did here as pagan rituals, as things that were associated with the devil, things that were uncivilized. And it's interesting now, so let's fast forward to now, how a lot of different people have imported Tibetan Buddhism or all kinds of other Buddhist ideas or all kinds of other mindfulness ideas into this country, because they, in a sense, had killed off all of the indigenous mindfulness practices, outlawed them through federal governments and missionaries, stomped those kinds of things out. So it's kind of an irony to me that people don't see that, that kind of thing that's happened. But yet people are gravitating toward it in huge, huge numbers now because it works.
Especially in this society, as you mentioned before, with so many distractions going on. I mean, we've got so much going on constantly. One of the things, I guess one of the benefits of my being is, being that, I grew up, used to be called hyperactive, now it's just ADD. Mm-hmm. You're easily distracted by lots of things. So what you develop is hyper-focus on, mm-hmm. on things. And I generally am focused on one thing at a time, very much so. And, so I do appreciate everything very intensely. It's just because I'm generally in that moment at that time, because I find being everywhere else amazingly distracting, and I'm easily distracted. So it's I kind of force... as a survival skill, force myself to be that way,
right,
on a regular basis.
Well, there's a lot of, and that's clear about a lot of folks too, because there's a literature too in what we call mindlessness, and that mindlessness is really a lot of what you're talking about. I mean, we're doing things mindlessly. Driving down the road is one example of that. People drive down the road and they remember leaving Ferndale, but they don't remember getting to L.A. until they start reaching the outskirts of the city. All the rest of the time they've been on autopilot, not seeing the side. They've been ruminating about different kinds of thoughts or listening to the music. They're not seeing the trees, not seeing the road. And in some
it's
cases,
almost as if they're not even conscious.
Right, yeah. It's kind of on autopilot, sort of what they used to call highway hypnosis. And a lot of us do that, without learning how to be conscientiously aware of what's happening and unfolding in the present moment. It's very difficult for any of us to kind of stay focused on one thing at a time, because this society, more than most societies now, because it's highly industrialized and it competes with the whole global society for the most products, the most money, the most everything, it keeps people very distracted in those kinds of things. When you watch TV, it's a very classic case of Americana here in this kind of new tech world. Commercials come up, they go, they come up, they go. There's bangs, there's bells, there's whistles, there's color, there's sight, there's sound, and boom, you're back to the short, movie that's going on, and boom, you're back into it again. And so the brain is actually receiving all this different kinds of stimuli that's going on and on, overloading it. Now, most people in neuropsychology or the different helping professions will say, don't watch TV before you go to bed. Because insomnia is an epidemic in this country, and that's one of the reasons why.
And that's when most people do watch TV, before they go to bed.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they're watching MMA, or they're watching, some kind of, movie that's really stimulating different circuits in the brain, and then they wake up and say, I was dreaming about this, and they say, oh, well, it sounds a lot like what you were watching last night, an axe murderer chasing me down the street kind of thing, right? So it's just we're a very overstimulated society, and there's a consequence for that. We know that causes more violence. We know it causes more cancer. We know it causes more hypertension and more depression, more anxiety, and we're seeing it in school children in school, and that's why mindfulness has been brought into a lot of schools. That's some of the work that I try to do. I'm trying to bring mindfulness into Native American schools across the country, and the term that I use, because Native American communities have been affected by colonialism, by American and European colonialism, and are still affected today. What I've branded the work that I do is neurodecolonization, trying to get people to use these really important neural circuits in the brain and to direct them in certain ways and to quiet down the ones that are really noisy and ineffective, and begin to activate those circuits, like in the prefrontal cortex or the insula of the brain, quiet down the amygdala and the hypothalamus and those ones that get a bit out of control when people suffer from too much oppression, too much anxiety, because of the forces of racism, because of the forces of uncertainty, because of of the forces, as I say, colonialism, that can really, really have a large effect on a population. So this is what I refer to as neurodecolonization.
It's a great term. That's yours, right?
Thanks. Yeah, it is.
It really is a good term. So we've dealt with violence in various different forms, you know, whether it is personal or cultural, and using mindfulness to help with that. Let's look at the other side of the picture, if we can. Those who perpetrate violence. I guess from your background, I don't know if you can speak from this, and we're just kind of throwing this out at you, about maybe is it a lack of mindfulness that's, you know, that's causing this kind of violence in society?
I think it's a combination of things. I think mindfulness certainly is one of the lack of mindfulness is certainly one of those things. But you know, one of the things that I think that's really fascinating right now about the brain is that the brain has this capacity to begin to be affected even before the baby is born. And from some studies, we're knowing that, you know, if mom is put under stress, if mom feels a sense of threats to her security, and she, you know, is with child and she's, you know, has a baby and the baby's developing, we're seeing that she is releasing different kinds of chemistry to that baby, things like cortisols or any of those kinds of adrenaline-like neurotransmitters that are affecting the baby, and it really affects the baby in development. And we know that from research that, you know, these things can be lifelong experiences for the baby, maybe more violence, maybe they're more prone to different kinds of habits of you know, substance abuse. The effects of negativity with respect to that are very high. So we know it starts very early. What a mother puts into her you know, what she eats, what she drinks, and what she perceives as, you know, threats around her certainly affect her. And that's why we know that it's so important to begin to reduce and to eliminate violence and to clean up the, you know, the water and the food sources that, you know, moms are going to be taking into their body, because it does affect not only them, but it affects the baby as well. So, you know, beginning and prompting violence starts at a very early age. Now, after babies are born, of course, some of them are already prompted, and maybe mom has been producing more testosterone. So the baby has got more testosterone as the baby is born. And some research indicates that that may be a thing that may trigger, you know, some kids as they get older, is that extra amount of testosterone they were born with while they were in mom's womb. Well, it's not mom's fault. Mom is doing exactly what mom needs to do. She's preparing that baby for an ugly, difficult world, because she's going through that experience. And that's the beauty of Mother Nature. That's what's happening. So the baby may come out with the testosterone levels that are a little higher, maybe than they're more elevated in life. Well, why? For more excitability, for more maybe aggressive behavior, not because the baby's bad, not because the mother's bad, but because society in itself has perpetuated this kind of violent environment. So when the baby comes out, the baby's, you know, geared up for this kind of, you know, sort of parachuting into this hot zone of life. And some of that research is kind of moving in that way, thinking about it. So it starts at a very early age. And there are all these other factors that, of course, we begin to institutionalize in society, like violence, violent sports, violent talk, violent metaphors or symbols, war talk, all those kinds of things are all begin to help, you know, the neural pathways develop in children and to make it to, you know, war or violence to be an okay thing. I mean, so it's all over, you know, the planet right now. I mean, war has been something people have been doing for a long time, but it's I think when you go back, and it's interesting when you go back to someone like Sun Tzu, who wrote The Art of War, talked about how important it was to, you know, the best warrior would never have to fight a war. He would learn how to deal with war by through a period of negotiation and a period of, you know, let's talk about this sort of thing. Let's not get into a war kind of thing. But, you know, we've kind of taken war now to a totally different level now, and violence to a totally different level. It's in games, it's on the TV, it's, you know, it's just all over the place. And so with that going on, I mean, the neural circuits are, you know, highly
charged,
activated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The beautiful thing about humanity is that despite the fact that sometimes we have the deck stacked against us, you know, we're in a violent society, we may have extra, you know, levels of neurotransmitters or testosterone in our systems, the nice thing about being a human being is that we have choice. We have the ability to choose one direction or another. There may be certain things that, as I said, that are stacked against us, that may have, we may have grown up in a violent household.
Mm-hmm.
But we can choose to break the cycle of violence. And that's the beautiful thing about the human mind, is that we have choice. We can actually choose to go in a different direction.
Right. I think one of the things that really resonates with what you're talking about is this thing that has been discovered called mirror neurons in the brain. Mirror neurons are almost like compassion neurons, or they could be used, both way, compassion or maybe aggression neurons. But mirror neurons are, the neurons in the brain that I'm sitting here watching what you're doing, drinking that cup of coffee, and I'm getting the taste sensation of the coffee because I'm a coffee drinker. And when you smile, I see, it sort of activates different circuits in my brain that, prompt me to want to smile. When you act peacefully, that activates those kinds of neural circuits and that kind of whole response in my body to want to be a more peaceful person. So in that sense, yes, it's clear that, people who understand the importance of peace, understand the importance of well-being, can be great role models to folks out there, right? And you have to think about, how we're coming across to other people, especially children, when they're using their mirror neurons to kind of see what mom and dad are doing. Dad talks nice to mom. Mom talks nice to dad. They treat each other lovingly. The child's neurons, mirror neurons, are going to be activated, and they're going to be watching and incorporating this as part of their learning process. And compassion is something that is a huge payoff when people practice mindfulness, sitting mindfulness, walking mindfulness, eating mindfulness, especially long practice of mindfulness really helps activate neurons of compassion in what they call the anterior cingulate cortex of the brain. And what we know about whether or not people have choice, and I'm going to get back to a little bit what you said about choice, we're going to go to another brain region called what people call the reptilian brain. It's part of the triune brain. And that part of the brain is, hundreds of millions of years old.
Primitive.
It's very primitive. And some neuroscientists jokingly say it houses the five Fs: fighting, feeding, fleeing, fearing, and fornicating. That's what human beings are good at. I don't know if I can say that on the radio.
Sure, you can.
Okay, well, I'm saying it on the radio. Those five things, and that's kind of what our fallback is to. Some people may or may not believe that, but this is sort of the evolutionary biology of the brain. Now, those are, hundreds of millions of years old. Our neurons of compassion are only about 17 million years old.
Right, they're layered on top of each other.
Yep, and those ones are more vulnerable. So the neurons of compassion and self-awareness and emotional and social intelligence, 17 million years old. And this is why it's much more easy for us to go into those five Fs: fighting, fleeing, fearing, and feeding, and those kinds of things, as opposed to having compassion for ourselves, having compassion for one another, having a self-awareness about what my behavior is like to other people, and I see what I'm doing. It's much more difficult to get to that place unless we begin to practice contemplative methods, whether it's really deep prayer. And you have to watch out with prayer, who you pray to, because the research also shows if you're praying to a fearful God, that's going to light up a totally different part of the brain as to someone who prays to a loving God, a God that says, I love everybody, I love everything, I want you to love the trees, the forests, the oceans, the moon, the sky, the stars, and there's no distinguishment between you and those things.
And everybody.
Yeah, everybody. I want you to love everybody. That's a very different part of the brain that is activated, different from the fear brain. That part of the brain is that compassion part of the brain, the self-awareness part of the brain. That's activated. So when you say, do we have a choice about acting in violence? And I'll say, yes, sometimes. But my thinking and looking at the science is that we have to really, really work at that because of how the brain is structured. We're more likely to go to fear and fighting and fleeing.
They're easier.
Yep. As opposed to going to compassion, love, and acceptance, and openness to other people.
Yeah, they're the easy ones to grab onto. But
right.
If we think about it a little further, we can go to compassion.
That's right.
And evolve.
That's right, absolutely.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time, But I want to thank you for coming in and talking, because it's been fascinating. I've really been really enjoying your talk.
Well, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate the invitation, and I hope anyone who's out there listening, please look up the resources, find somebody in the community, and I think the benefits of mindfulness are absolutely amazing. It takes a while, and many of the studies that we have show that long-term meditation has great, great benefits and payoffs.
All righty. Professor Michael Yellowbird, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And I want to remind folks that tomorrow we wrap up our campaign with our Healing Breakfast. It goes from 8 until 10. It's at the Werfinger Building. We'll have all kinds of wonderful guests. We're going to be having a panel discussion. Carolyn Lehman, author of Strong at the Heart, is going to be doing our keynote address, and very excited. She's got some new information that she wants to share with us. There will be tables from various different resources throughout the community. Some wonderful organizations will be there with tables and information. If you just want to talk with someone, that's a great place to do so. We're going to be having wonderful pastries from Velatini Baking Company. We'll have delicious coffee from Signature Coffee. And even Amy's going to be baking some stuff as well. So it's going to be pretty good. Also music from Luke Sikora. It's going to be really wonderful. So we'll see you there tomorrow morning starting at 8 o'clock. I know it's a little bit early, but it's worth it, I think. And it's absolutely free. This conversation, as all our conversations in this campaign, will be archived momentarily at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo.